Sorry. Genesis chapter 47, verses 27, we start there. And what has taken place is, of course, Jacob has met his brothers. They've settled in the land of Goshen. And then we moved into verse 13. We read it at the end of class, verse 13 through 26, where it talks about Joseph dealing with the situation in Egypt with the famine, where, you know, they sold. And again, this is, there's 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine, and this is now probably the start of the third year, third through 7 years is what this, the verses cover before this, where he begins to sell them the grain. And once they run out of, you know, money, he then starts getting their cattle, and then he gets the land, and then they sell themselves. And so they're all working. And of course, as we ended last week, they get to keep 80%, the government supplies them with the grain. They get to keep 80% of the produce, and 20% comes back into the government. And so it seems like a real great setup. The people are still being productive. They're still responsible. And I've wondered, and we've talked about this a little bit after class a couple times, is it's interesting, where does Joseph show up in, like, when did Jesus talk about Joseph? You know, you don't hear him saying things about him. And what is this part? Is this some kind of a reflection of how Jesus will rule and reign in his kingdom? We don't know. It's important, but it just kind of is there, just like a historical account. But there's not a lot of reference back to it. And so that's what we see in the chapters leading up. So Joseph has the land, and that's probably referring to, you know, the 7 years of famine that's left, or the 5 years of the famine that's left. At the top of the page of your notes, we're going to begin now tonight, chapter 47, verses, you know, where we start, and up to chapter 48, verse 1. We're going to find out that Jacob is near death. That's what it's going to talk about. Now, at first, there's going to be 17 years. Jacob comes into the land at 130. He's there for 17 years, and then at 147, he's going to die. So this 17 years is what's taking place in these next few chapters. It's fairly silent. I would say it's almost totally silent, except Jacob is going to call Joseph and make him swear an oath, a vow, an oath that he'll take him back when he dies, that he'll take him back and bury him in the land of Canaan. So that's the only thing we know that takes place during this 17 years is sometime, and we don't know if that happens sometime during that 17 years or if it's at towards the end. But now, tonight, he's going to be near his death. In chapter 48, verse 1, in chapter 47, verse 29, he's frail. And then he's going to call Joseph's sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, and he's going to bless them. And what's going to take place then is those two sons are going to become, go from being grandsons to become sons of Jacob. Now again, they're not genetically his sons. They're not doing some transitioning. They're simply going to be brought into the estate, into the inheritance, as two sons along with all the other sons. In other words, it becomes Joseph gets, in a sense, a double blessing or a double portion. Then in chapter 49, which I'm real looking forward to it, I hope it's useful and interesting for you. We'll do that next time. Chapter 49, he's going to bless his 12 sons. And some of that has prophecy. It's a blessing, but also a prophecy. And then Jacob's death and burial is in chapter 49, 28, up through chapter 50, verse 14. And then the last little bit is going to be Joseph and his brothers in Egypt leading up to Joseph's death. And that's the end. So that's a little bit of an outline of what's taking place. But now, after talking about how Joseph solves the issues in the land, we begin in Genesis 47, verse 27. It says, "Thus Israel settled in the land of Egypt." We were there up in verse 12 that they were settling. Then we spent verses 13 through 26 talking about what Joseph's job was doing, what he was doing as the administrator. And now we return back to now Israel, Jacob, is settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, and they gain possessions in it and were fruitful and multiplied. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, so the days of Jacob the years of his life were 147. So what takes place is, again, they're living in that land. What we just read was all the land had gone to Pharaoh. And we know from previous verses that the priests of Egypt, they were allowed to keep their land, so they've got land that they kept. But also the land of Goshen is given to, we'll just say, Israel. And it, the way it's worded, they're not just renting it. This is their possession. They are possessing the land of Goshen. And so what we read before we got to this section is all the land goes to Pharaoh, and then Joseph also got land for Israel in Goshen. And that's kind of where it's at. They're living in that land, and that's what those verses are talking about. It says that Joseph or Jacob is going to live 147 years. I just pointed out, I said it last week also. The ideal age for an Israelite is an Egyptian is to live 110 years. So Jacob and his ancestors are well above the perfect age, but what's as far as the Egyptian in their literature. What's interesting, and I've got it written down there, chapter 47, verse 28, the first bullet point, Joseph, if you notice in chapter 50, verse 22 and 26, guess how old he's going to be? Joseph's going to live 110 years. He's going to match the perfect age that the Egyptians considered the ideal age. It's just interesting that that takes place. Again, it says there's no details of what takes place during those 17 years that they're in. We're missing conversations. We're missing, you know, storylines. There's got to be things happening, but nothing said except this point right here, beginning in chapter 27, verse 29. And when the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him. So now it seems like all these things from the rest of this chapter that's dealing with Jacob is he is near his death. He's frail. He's 147. And that would include this. So when we talk about Joseph giving an oath, it seems like that was something Jacob was thinking about near his death. And so he calls Joseph, his son, and said to him, "If now I have found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt." So he calls Joseph, and Joseph apparently, as we looked at the map before that we've created, if that's legitimate or not, if that's, you know, we're trying to put pieces together, Joseph would have left where he's living down in the oasis, came up to Goshen to see his father because he's near his death. But and the reason he's called him is he's asking Joseph to take an oath, to make a covenant, and he's going to make this official. It's going to be, in a sense, a signed document that it's not just a promise, but it's an oath that's going to hold him accountable to God. I mean, there's one thing about making a promise. You never want to lie. But there's also something that Joseph is going to be brought by Jacob into this covenant that you're going to have to answer to God if you don't do this. I do not want to be buried in Egypt. He's going to die in Egypt, but he doesn't want to be buried there. And this is, I'll just read this and explain a little bit about it. "If now I found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place." He answered, I will do as you have said. And he said, "Swear to me." So that, yes, I will do it. Now I want you to swear to me, meaning take the oath. And he said, "Swear to me," and he swore to him. Then Israel bowed himself upon the head of his bed. So Jacob is being used interchangeably and try to find a difference. Jacob is the man who struggles. Israel is the man who's blessed by God. He bows. He's not getting out of bed. Interesting things about this, and I've got that written down. Where is it? Verse chapter 47, verse 29 on the notes. It's just interesting because it gives you, it, under his thigh, and we've seen this other places, it could be directly under the thigh, but that could be an euphemism for genitals. In other words, you know, put your hand on my genitals. Again, it's like a very covenant place, a personal place. Touching the genitals in an oath ceremony in Akkadian letter in ancient Mesopotamia, that's been seen in an Akkadian letter which was an empire that was in what is modern Iraq between 2334 and 2154, you know, up until within 100 years, 200 years of this time. It's documented in a letter that that's what they were doing, not just putting their hand under the thigh, but actual on the genitals and swearing and making a covenant. Now he's bound by the oath under God's protection that when Jacob dies, he's going to carry him back. Now, chapter 47, verse 30 in the notes, this is mentioned again in chapter 50, verse 5. It says, in a tomb I hewed out for myself. Now, the verse says, my father, Jacob, Joseph now in chapter 50 is reminding everyone what his responsibility is in chapter 50 and gives you a little more insight. He says in chapter 50, verse 5, my father made me swear, saying, I'm about to die in my tomb that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan, there shall you bury me. And so we know what they're talking about here, and it's still a monument today. It's the city of Hebron, and there is a place there that Abraham buried himself there, and that's where Isaac was buried. Sarah was buried there. The one of the wives, Leah, is buried there, and now Jacob is going to go. And we talked last night, like for example, Joseph of Arimathea had cut his tomb, and we saw rolling stone tombs on picture last night. And they would cut into the rock some kind of a tomb with a shelf on it for the bed. Then they'd put the bones in an ossuary box and set it on the shelf. They've discovered the tomb of Caiaphas, the high priest that tried Jesus several years ago there in South Jerusalem, of the old city. There had had a caterpillar, and it fell down into the ground, and it actually fell or collapsed into something into the a cave, a carved out area, and if they found in the Israeli Museum is the ossuary of Caiaphas. It's a very decorated ossuary. It's got his name on it, it's got his bones, and the guy that tried Jesus, they found the dust of his bones in this ossuary box, and so they found out this was the tomb of the high priest's family, and so he wasn't laid out on a shelf, you know, on a tomb. He had been, and then his bones were put in a box and put on the shelf. And so there's all the family members in this tomb. So Hebron would be something similar. Now again, we're talking there 30 AD, 40, 50 AD. This is going back to 2000 BC. But it's similar. It's a family tomb. And they would cut in the rock. They could share the same burial bench. Then the bones would be gathered in. And if you care, in these tombs, there would be, in a sense, there are tombs like this where there's a burial bench carved in the rock, and that's just a bad illustration, that's just, you know, it's carved in, and then underneath this would be carved in the rock, but underneath here would be a little trough that's open, like a box, that you could take the bones that would lay up here, the skeleton would lay here, the body would lay here, and then the bones would be gathered and put in a box just underneath the bench. And so then someone else would die a few years later, they'd lay there, and then the bones could be put in the box under the burial bench, and so you'd be gathered to your fathers. Your bones would be gathered to your fathers. That occurs. In the New Testament, they have these ossuary boxes. I've showed you pictures of them. I'm not sure if we've got any around here. And they just have different boxes, and they're not, you know, they're big enough for, you know, some bones. But they could also have something like this. And what they would have is, and Jacob tells you right here in chapter, or Joseph refers to what his father told him. He says, I'm about to die in my tomb that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan. So there would have been in Hebron, in the burial place, a tomb for Abraham, a tomb for Sarah, a tomb for Isaac, a tomb for Rebekah. And then Jacob, while he was alive, he cut himself his own tomb. Now, once again, when he says I hewed, did he like watch his servants cut it out, or did he go out there, you know, a couple days a week and chisel out a burial place? You know, that's what he's saying. Also, as we talk about this, remember that there's a well at Shechem that was dug by Jacob, and you can still see it. There's still water, and you can still view it, see the water. You can still drink water out of it, and it's it's right in the rock. They just kept digging, chipping rock until they got down below the rock level and tapped into water. And Jesus was there with the woman at the well that was dug by Jacob. And so Jacob, if he did it himself, or his servants did it, or him and his sons did it, they cut through bedrock down. And it's there today, because it's not, you're not like in Iowa, when you dig a hole, you get a shovel and you start digging dirt. You just, and then by the end of the summer, it's filled in because the dirt washes in. But if you're chiseling through rock, it's going to be there, you know, 4,000 years later. It's still that channel that you cut through the bedrock is still there in the water source. So Jacob's well that he himself chiseled out, or his servants chiseled out, or however, he takes credit for it. And here is him chiseling out his tomb right by Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And this place has been excavated, and there are, this time of period, you know, 2000 BC, there are burial spots in this tomb that it's hard to get to because it's controlled by the Muslims, and you can't just waltz in there like you can other places. And it's an elaborate new building. Well, it's still a Herodian building. It was built, Herod built that up just like he built up the Temple Mount. And so you have to get past the Herodian building and go back to each generation, going back to what was there originally in the land of Hebron when Abraham cut his grave. So Jacob is asking Joseph to make sure he takes him back and buries him there. And once again, the reason for that is they're focusing on the land of Canaan. They're in Egypt. They're in a sense not just sojourning there. They own property. We got to understand they own the land of Goshen, but they know there's this promise hanging over their head that they've got to go back. The promises are not going to be fulfilled except in the land. They can't say, "Well, we've moved here, now bless us here." No, you're here for a time, but you have to get back to the land, which again, in my mind, you know, if it's my culture, if it's the way I live, the way I've been raised, it's like, you know, like I got kids all over the world at different times, you know, well, someday they'll come home. It's like, where? West Des Moines? I mean, I've only lived here 25 years. My home is, well, I grew up in Thompson, but my dad is a superintendent. We also live here. And he came from Spencer, but, you know, they were immigrants from the 1800s that came over and got farmland, and so they're actually from Germany. But you get back that far, we're from Germany, we're from Scotland, we're from England, we're from, and now you're from, by the time you get back five generations, you're from, there's no homeland. I mean, we're going to go back to, well, Weimers is German, but the other eight lines of my family are all other different. So it's like there's no home, there's no place to return. But this is not just cultural, this is involving the promise that God gave these people. And again, this is Bible history, this is interesting information, but it's still happening today. I mean, this is still driving politics, it's still driving culture. Your interpretation of this, I mean, wouldn't it be nice just to say this is all just mythology and it doesn't matter and just, you know, go your own way? But it's like, if this is the Word of God and these are the promised people, now you start coming up with, well, what about Israel and who are the people of God? And, you know, are you anti-Semitic? Are you a Zionist? What are you doing? Well, however this plays out for these people, for Jacob talking to Joseph, is I need to get back to Canaan, and I want you burying me in the tomb I cut out, because this story does not just deviate to Egypt and we'll just keep moving around the world. We need to get back to Canaan. And you know that because when you turn the page after chapter 50 of Genesis, you turn to Exodus, and now what are they doing? Well, they don't remember Joseph. There's a different Pharaoh. They're all slaves, and God finds Moses and says, "Go get my people. And we're going back to the promised land. I'm going to pick things up." And he told Abraham, it's not even radical. He told Abraham, your descendants will be enslaved in Egypt for four generations, for 400 years. And then in the fourth generation, I'll bring them back up here and pick. Then you know the rest of the Old Testament. So even there, Jacob has gone down to the land, but he, as he's getting ready to die, he wants to make clear to everybody, I cannot be buried here. He wants to go back to the promised land. And it has, I think, a huge hint of an anticipation of life after death, of that there's some kind of a resurrection. Like we read last night in I think it's the Gospel of John, where it says the Sadducees, no, it is Mark, the Sadducees do not believe in the resurrection. They don't believe the priests, the priestly class in Jesus' day, their theology had devolved in the place that they did not believe in the afterlife. These were the priests that the people were bringing sacrifices to. This, it says in the text, the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection. Now the Pharisees, guys like the Apostle Paul, Saul, when he was a Pharisee, they believed in the resurrection. So there's this, there's the conservatives, and then there's the priests, the liberals. And the conservatives held to the law, wanted to know the text, because with the text they could have authority over the priest, but the priests had authority because of lineage and position, so if they could somehow control the Pharisees, they could do whatever they wanted. But the Pharisees kept them in check, which were the lawyers, kept the priests, the aristocrats, in check because we've got the law. So there's this conflicting power going on, but they both united to come against Jesus. But nonetheless, here's a clear hint, I think, that these people believe in life after death. And as we saw last night, Jesus asked them a question, you know, what do you say about the resurrection? How do you explain that Moses, when God appeared to Moses, God himself says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now they were all dead by that time, but God is still speaking in present tense. I am, I'm still their God. Now they're in the underworld in Sheol, but I'm still their God actively. And so the Pharisees, the Sadducees, we can't answer that. We don't know. And so that's that kind of interesting, because you kind of see that resurrection taking place right here. Now, chapter 47, verse 31, that's just the oath. And he said, swear to me, and he swore to him. Then Israel bowed himself upon the head of his bed. Some take that and they translate it on the staff by his bed. So there's some words being taken place here, but I think basically Israel, Jacob is in bed, on a bed, and he's now bowing down, and he's bowing down in worship to God because he knows he's going back to the promised land. And again, it can't be emotions. I mean, it can't be, well, I just emotionally want to be, you're dead. But he knows it means something of the future, the resurrection, the promised land, the people. There's something even probably beyond maybe what he understands, even what I can comprehend. It's important to be there. Okay, chapter 48. After this, Joseph was told, behold, your father is ill. So now notice he's there with him taking the oath. It appears that he went back home after taking that oath. Jacob was near 147, but Jacob has returned. Now someone comes down, you know, one of the brothers, some kind of messenger, a courier, said, behold, your father is ill. So he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. So this is another interesting story. Manasseh and Ephraim, his two sons. Now, I'll show you here in a minute. Manasseh's probably 24, Ephraim's probably 22, and I'll show you the math here in just a moment. Again, that's an estimate. Maybe that's 25, maybe that's 23, but it's not 5 and 3, and it's not 90 and 88 or something. So Joseph leaves wherever he's at, back in his palace, back down by the oasis. He goes up with his two sons, Manasseh, the oldest, and Ephraim. And it was told to Jacob, your son Joseph has come to you. Now he hears this. Then Israel summoned his strength, or some translation, rallied his strength. I mean, he hears it. He's like, oh, I'm dying. Oh, I can't breathe. I'm so in debt. Joseph is here. Oh, I'll be fine. You know, I mean, he rallied. He's now energized for the moment. He's still old, he's still dying, but he does respond. He summoned his strength. Whatever he's got left, he's got business. And again, Jacob has business to take care of. I'm reading this to you. I'm going to tell you about it, but I don't fully understand what is going on here. I mean, like some secret message, some secret code. And it was told to Jacob, your son Joseph has come to you, which means it wasn't a daily occurrence. They're all not living happily there in Goshen. The Israelites are, but Joseph is running the Egyptian empire. Then Israel summoned his strength and sat up in the bed. So now he's still in the bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty, or there's El Shaddai, appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. Now that is the past. He's talking about in the past, God has blessed him. At the end of his life, Jacob is going to repeatedly be talking about God has blessed him. God has walked before him. And he's now begins his conversation with Joseph and says, God appeared to me. And right there, God appeared. It was a theophany. I didn't sense God's presence. I didn't pray to God. I didn't feel God's inner voice. El Shaddai appeared to me. That shouldn't be strange. He appeared multiple times to Abraham in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make you a company of people and will give this land to your offspring after you for an everlasting possession. Now, that is the part of that blessing, what God told him at Luz. That's when the Lord appeared to him and they met face to face. Part of that's taking place. He's blessed. He's multiplied. He's got sons. He's got grandsons. But also, and he's become a company of people, but the land is still there. That company of people have left the land. So it comes back to the land. I will give this land to your offspring after you. Now, this is an important word, for an everlasting possession. Olam. You can see it somewhere. I've got it written down there. What am I? I'm chapter 48. Oh, I got to turn the page. I wrote it down there somewhere. Do you see it? Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, chapter 48, verse 3 and 4. Egypt is temporary, Canaan is olam, that's the Hebrew word, it means forever, meaning Abraham was told they're going to be there for 4 generations, 400 years, but they're coming back. So Goshen is their dwelling. Goshen, they own the land. They're not sojourners. Sojourners are just wandering around like they have been in Canaan. But now they've got a possession in Goshen. But that's not where we're going to stay. We're our possession forever. And again, you've got to take that into consideration. Olam is forever. So the land of Israel is the land of Israel. We're still in that time frame of forever. And so it's still their land. Now, they can be, as the prophet said, be driven from the land in punishment. But all those prophets, if it be Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, all those prophets, you'll be driven from the land. Jesus talks about it. You'll be driven from the land, but I will bring you back. But I will bring you back. They've left the land in Egypt, but they will come back. And that's going to be a repeated. Now, again, we don't know exactly where we're at in history, but that principle contains. Israel may be gone, but they will come back. Now, have they come back? You know, today there's a land of people living there in Israel. They go through Romans. Not all Israel is Israel. You know, they need to be believers. And that's a whole interesting, are we in the process of what's going on? Again, that's eschatology. But he talks about the land. It will be lasting forever. Chapter 48, verse 5. And now this is a great verse. And now, this is why he's got Joseph up there with his two sons. And now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Now you won't catch it. You won't catch it. I'll read it to you again. And now, but I mean, I'm not insulting you. I'm just saying it's not obvious. But when I show it to you, it's like, oh my gosh, it's already starting. And now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are. Now, what just took place right there, if you go back to verse 2, chapter 48, And it was told Jacob, your son Joseph has come to you. Oh, no, excuse me, verse 1. After this, Joseph was told, behold, your father is ill. So he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Now Joseph, or Jacob sees them, and he says, what we're going to do right here is your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine as Reuben and Simeon are. Now, interesting, Reuben and Simeon are Jacob's number one and number two sons. They're going to have the same standing as, for example, Reuben and Simeon. And he says, Joseph brought his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, but Jacob says, Ephraim and Manasseh will be just like Reuben and Simeon, 1 and 2. Ephraim will be like Reuben, Manasseh will be like Simeon, and Joseph doesn't catch on. He doesn't catch it. But what Jacob has just said is what he's going to do. Here's my two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. I'm going to make Ephraim and Manasseh just like Reuben and Simeon. Great. Okay, so what you first hear, he's just going to bring them in as his sons. In other words, you're going to have, instead of the 12 sons, you're going to have 14. On the paperwork, on the estate, you know, they're not really his sons, you know, in the family tree, but as far as the estate comes, they're going to be considered as getting, when we start divvying out who's got what, they're getting the son's portion, which means Joseph's getting a double portion. But what he does is he switches these names. And Jacob, or apparently Joseph, doesn't catch it yet. And now, he makes it clear, and now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came, I'm only talking about these two sons. We don't know, there's no record of it, but there's room for that Joseph most likely had other children. They're not included in this. They're not going to be like 1, 2, 3 for all these children, because it says, verse 6, and the children that you fathered after them shall be yours. So if that's in the past tense, that you fathered after them. So it appears that after Jacob got to the land, Joseph has started having, during these 17 years, the last 5 years of the famine, and the last 17 years, that Joseph has had more children. But they're not included in these two. So we don't know the details of that. And the children that you have fathered after them shall be yours. They shall be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. So where are Joseph's other kids supposed to go? They're going to be under, they're either going to be part of Ephraim or they're going to be part of Manasseh. And you'll see this as we go into, you know, when they start dividing the land up. Manasseh and Joseph doesn't get a portion of the land. When Joshua divides it up for the tribes, there's the land of Manasseh and the land of Ephraim. You've got Manasseh, some on both sides of the Jordan, and you've got Ephraim has got his land there. But where's Joseph's land? It's in Ephraim and Manasseh. And where's all of Joseph's other kids? They're going to be put in here. And Jacob's laying this down. So all it's doing right here, so far, the only thing that's happened that is obvious is he's saying, your sons, I'm going to give you a double portion. They're going to be considered my sons when I die and we start dividing things up. The other sons will be called by the names of their brothers in their inheritance. As for me, now you wonder why does he's got 12 sons. Why does he need two more sons? I don't know that. I do not know why is he adopting these sons. And I don't know why he's switching these. And that we haven't seen the big switch yet, but he's already alluded to it. But the best guess, because at this point, at the point of his death, he's 147 years old. He's had all kinds of adventures, all kinds of life. He's now living in Egypt. And when he says this, he goes to this point right here. As for me, when I came from Padan, meaning Padan Aram, coming out of Syria, coming from Laban's house, to my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan. So if I'm going to make a guess why he's taken Joseph's two sons is because I wished I'd had more time with Rachel, because that was the woman that he loved, and I wished I had more children with her. I wish she had more of an inheritance that Rachel's name. And so I'm going to take her son, Joseph, I'm going to take your first two sons to give her a total of four sons. Again, is he doing it for Rachel? It doesn't say it clearly, but it doesn't say, I don't think, and you guys can correct me if you see something. As for me, when I came from Paddan Aram to my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan on the way when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath. And I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. When Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, now verse 8 begins the ceremony. Now I do have written down here on this paper the thing that I don't see it. Rachel, chapter 48, verse 7. Rachel had prayed at Joseph's birth. In chapter 30, verse 24, she says, may Yahweh add another son for me. So she was, after when Joseph was born, she was praying for another son. And she did have Benjamin. And then, of course, he dies and her birthing stopped. I did not show you this, and it's in your notes. Manasseh and Ephraim, their ages at this time. Do you see on that first page right there? If we can do this, I haven't gone over this. I said it, but I didn't go over it. You've got 7 years of famine, or plenty, 7 years of famine, all right? And that's what I've got written down there. Joseph was married right away. If we say Manasseh, the oldest, was born in the second year, that means there was 5 years of that famine left. And then if Ephraim was born, like, say, in the fourth year, there's 3 years left. Is that what I've got on there? Okay, so they were 5 years old and 3 years old at the end of the time of plenty. I said famine, at the time of plenty. So Manasseh's first 5 years were during the last 5 years of the plenty. Ephraim's were the last 3 years of the time of plenty. And then you've got to add 7 years of the famine, but at the same time, what we want to use is that 17 years that Jacob's been in the land. So they came into the land of Egypt probably at the beginning of the third year or during that second year. So we're only going to take those 2 years. They lived 2 years, both Manasseh and Ephraim, before Jacob and the family arrived for the full 17 years that Jacob was in the land. Does that make sense at all, how I did that? You can't just add 7 and 7 because 17 overlaps the 7 years of famine also. So 2 years were spent without Jacob and the brothers being in there. So if you add 17 years that the family's been there, the 2 years that they lived in the famine before the family arrived, and the 5 years that Manasseh was alive during, then he is 24 years old, and Manasseh's 24, and Ephraim is 20. Is that what I got right there? 22. I got 24 and 22 years old. That would be their age. Again, that's an estimate. We don't have birth dates on here, but they're not, because we're going to get to a place where these boys are being brought in, and some translations say they sat on Jacob's knees. And so if you get a Sunday school picture of this, you've got an old man sitting on his bed and two little boys sitting on his knees, which means Jacob got into the land of Canaan sometime during the second or third or fourth year of the years of plenty before the famine started, because Manasseh and Ephraim were born early in this time period. And so you've got to get this age figured out. And so they're not, I mean, it's just going to be, also his blindness is going to come up. Okay, going back, here we go. So possibly one of the reasons why he brings up these two boys is for Rachel. I don't know, but he's bringing them as his sons. Now begins the ceremony where they're going to be adopted. This is the ceremony. And some people stumble on this. When Israel, that's Jacob, when Jacob saw Joseph's sons, he says, whose are these? Now, if you're reading this as a narration, you're reading this as like in Joseph brings his two sons in, and he brings Manasseh and Ephraim, and Jacob says, I'm going to take Ephraim and Manasseh and make them just like my sons Reuben and Simeon, and then he bows down, and then Joseph brings the sons in, and Israel says, who are these? It's like, What's wrong? Are you losing your mind? What's wrong with you? I can't see very good. Well, I wrote in the notes, if I can find my place in the notes, it's chapter 48, verse 8, and you know this. Whose sons are these? Is ceremonial, just like at a baptism, you bring your baby in to be baptized, and the officiant will say, what name is given to this child? And then the mother looks at the husband and says, well, I was thinking maybe like Bobby. It's like, well, yeah, but that's not a family name. And then they start talking about, well, the baby's already got a name. Or it's like going to a wedding, and they've spent, you know, $3,000 on flowers, and there's bridesmaids and groomsmen, and they're all dressed up, and everybody's there. And they ask, who gives this woman to this man? It's like, I don't know. Did we even tell our parents yet? Her mother and I, or whatever. It's like those are ceremonial questions. We know the baby's already got a name. We know that the parents have approved of this, but we're going to do the ceremony. What name are we going to give this child? Who gives this woman to this man? And that's what this is. When he sees them, he says, whose are these? Meaning we're beginning the ceremony of adoption. This is all ceremony now. Joseph said to his father, they are my sons. In the Hebrew, my sons are they. And he doesn't say, my sons are they that I had with the priestess's daughter here in Egypt. He says, my sons are they whom God has given me here. These are my sons, and God gave them to me here in Egypt. Then he says, and he said to him, bring them to me, please, that I may bless them. And now, in Joseph is a conservative, he's a traditionalist, and there's going to be the right hand of blessing and the left hand of blessing. He's going to bless both sons. And so Joseph is going to take Manasseh, and as Joseph is standing there, it's going to be on Joseph's, because Joseph's standing left and right, as Jacob is sitting here right and left, he's going to put Manasseh on Joseph's left side, right in front of Jacob's right hand, and Ephraim, the secondborn, on his left hand. So it'd be just the opposite for Joseph. And he's going to put them there so he can bless them. He's going to adopt them as part of, that's Joseph's double blessing. And so Joseph puts them there. And that's what's going to take place now. Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age, so he could not see. Now this, again, you're going to have to interpret this, because it doesn't say Israel was blind. It says he was dim with age, so he could not see, because in a moment he's going to be seeing things and talking about things. But I think it's like at a distance, he can recognize at least shapes of people. So Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And the kiss would be a greeting, but the embrace would be something a little bit longer. So he's going to kiss Manasseh, who's on his right, and then he's going to embrace him. So Jacob, the old man, 147, frail, has been in every time, this whole time period, he's in a bed. He's embracing him. And then he's going to kiss and embrace the other one. Then and Israel, he kissed and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your offspring also. So he's praising God. Then Joseph removed them from his knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. So several, he brought them up right there. Jacob kisses and embraces them, and then says to Joseph, I never thought I would see you again, and here are your sons. Joseph at that time takes the sons from his knees. Now, if you want to say them from his knees, like off his knees, you've got a 24-year-old sitting on the lap of a 147-year-old man who's frail and has been frail for years. Or they were standing up by his knees, which I think makes sense. They walked up, they're young men, they walk up, one's on by his right side by his knees, and Joseph then leads them back away, and Joseph bows down to his father, which is very interesting, because remember the dream, the father's going to bow down, but now Joseph is paying respect, not that it has anything to do with it, but Joseph is the one that ends up bowing down. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim, okay, wait, excuse me. Then Joseph removed them from his knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth in front of his father. That's part of the ceremony. Verse 13, and Joseph then took them both, Ephraim in his right hand. And again, when I say this right here, you've got Joseph is walking up this way, right hand, left hand. And Joseph, Jacob is sitting on the bed facing him, right hand, left hand. So Joseph's right hand is Jacob's left hand. If you, I'm not getting you confused. Well, I am trying to explain it to you. You're like, okay, we're not in third grade. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm more of a third grade teacher. Then Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, even the text explains it, and Manasseh in Joseph's left hand towards Israel's right hand. The oldest is here, the youngest is here, and brought them near him. And Israel stretched out his right hand, Jacob stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim. No! Who was the younger, and his left hand on the head of Manasseh, crossing his hands, for Manasseh was the firstborn, if you haven't been paying attention. It says that in the text. And what he does is like this. Now remember when Esau came to Isaac and says, bless me. He says, well, who are you? I'm your son Esau. He said, I've already given the blessing. And it's like, but they lied. Jacob lied to you. He's a deceiver. And Isaac says, there's nothing I can do. I gave him the entire blessing. Right, but in my court of law, he gave him the blessing under false pretense. That cancels the blessing. But in this world, Isaac says, I can't take it back. I spoke the blessing. I was lied to, and I gave the blessing away I was deceived, and there's nothing I can do about it. Wow, that's not American law right there. That's strange to me. Well, so this happens. He brings him up, right hand, left hand, and while Joseph is watching, going like, what? He rattles off the blessing, and he blessed Joseph and said, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day. So he says, the God whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked. So he gives credit to Abraham and Isaac as walking before God, being obedient, but he doesn't say, and I've walked before God. Instead, he reverses it and says, and God who has been my shepherd, my God who's walked before me all the days. So my fathers walked before God in obedience, but God has walked before me and been faithful to me all this day. I haven't earned it. God has been faithful to me because of the covenant. He keeps leading me, and I just need to keep following. And then he switches from God to the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the boys. And the angel is not an angel. That's the messenger. And I've got it written down there somewhere on these notes. The angel appeared to, somewhere on here, you can't see it, but appeared to Hagar. The angel appeared to and fought with Jacob. The angel has appeared to him several times. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in Paddan Aram and told him to leave Laban. So in any time of circumstance where there is difficulty, the angel of the Lord, which is not a sense of theophany, it is, but it is the Son of God. It's the manifestation of God coming to deliver Jacob physically from a situation. So he says, God, my father's walked and has led me, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the boys. And in them let my name be carried on and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. So he goes like this, says the God that has that my fathers followed, the God that has led me, the angel that has brought me out of trouble, bless these boys and make them multiply. It's like, and Joseph's like, when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. And he took his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's. So it's talking there about he took this hand, the right hand, not the left hand. He takes the right hand, goes, no, over here. But the thing is, as the story goes, he didn't do this, and then Joseph starts trying to move the hands. He does this and rattles off the blessing, and Joseph's like, no. He comes up, grabs it, over here. And Joseph said to his father, not this way, my father, since this one is the firstborn, put your right hand on his head. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. Now there's your Hebrew word, yada, okay? Yada, my son, yada, I know, I know. Now there's a place in the text, I might have it written down in here, where Jacob says, I do not know. Earlier in his life, I do not know. I'm confused, I do not know. Here, at this point in life, he doesn't say, I do not know. It's not, I lo yada, lo means not, lo yada. He says, yada, my son, yada. I know what I'm doing. He's confident. Now, why is he doing this? Why is he switching this? It's not clear. But it has to be divine. It has to be spirit-led. It has to be in God's plan. But his father refused and says, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. In other words, but you notice the blessings. It was right and left, and the exact same blessing. The only difference was right and left. He will be the chief. He'll be the leader. He'll have the same blessing, but will be lesser and not as much as the first. It says, he also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his offspring shall become a multitude of nations. So he blessed them that day, saying, may you, Israel, by you, Israel, will pronounce blessings, saying, God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. So notice, Ephraim is to become a multitude of nations. Now, Ephraim is what northern Israel eventually is going to be called. It's Ephraim and Judah. They're not called Israel. They are at times, but they're also called Ephraim by the prophets. And they were the ones that were dispersed, you remember, by the Babylon, Judah, and the tribe of Benjamin, and all the tribes of Israel that fled and to hide and get refuge in Judah. They were taken to Babylon and brought back. So all the 12 tribes went and came back. But those northern tribes, northern 10 tribes with the Assyrians, they are dispersed to the nations. They're thrown to the wind. Now, we talk about the lost 10 tribes of Israel. You can, except for the fact that just as before they are being dispersed, they are running down to Judah because they're being invaded. They're crossing the border. In fact, Hezekiah had to build an extension of the city. You can see the city expand in 700 BC as they're fleeing from the coming invasion. But many of them were taken and dispersed, and Ephraim became a multitude. I'm not sure if that's included in this or not. Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I'm about to die, but God will be with you and will bring you again to the land of your fathers. So yeah, he's already made him promise, you're going to bury me there, but understand, you're going back too. He says, the promised land is your home. Moreover, I have given to you rather than to your brothers. Now, this is a very interesting verse. One mountain slope, that word is shoulder. It can be translated shoulder or back. That I took from the land of the Amorites with my sword and with my bow. Now, first of all, that is not recorded anywhere in Genesis. Before you start trying to figure it out, you need to know there's no one knows what that's referring to. But there's some place that he fought a battle against the Amorites, which is a general term for Canaanites. And we're going to find out as we go through, because Joseph's going to be buried there, that is in the land of Shechem. It's by Shechem. So the one idea is that when Dinah was taken and the men of Shechem were tricked into being circumcised, and then the brothers went in and slaughtered them, that was the time that Jacob took the land from the Hittites or the Amorites. But if you remember, Jacob was very upset with his brothers or with his sons. In fact, a couple are going to get cursed in this next chapter because of what they did there. It would appear that when he came back from Paddan Aram, if I'm going to put this in, because we know where the land's at, it's right by Shechem. And when we read when he came back to the land, it says, the fear of everyone fell on them. The fear of Jacob and his people fell on them. And then it says he bought land from Haman, the leader of Shechem. So it would appear there was some kind of a skirmish, some kind of a battle, and he took some land and then some kind of peace negotiation that then purchased some of it, and they settled there. And that's why Jacob was so upset when his sons tricked him and went in and slaughtered him, because he bought some land and had made peace. We don't know that that's the best we can come up with that. But Joseph is given that land. And when you read in Joshua 24:32, you can read Joshua 24:32. That's where they take Joseph's bones and bury him in that land of Shechem that was given to him at this time by Jacob. So that Joseph is buried, not in the family tomb at Hebron, but on the land that was given to him by his father, that his father took with his sword and his arrow from the Amorites there at Shechem. Now, when that happened, we don't know, but it definitely is a reality. And that's where Joseph's bones were taken out of this tomb right here when Moses left. They took the sarcophagus, probably mummified, took them out, and then later on the Egyptians apparently trashed that whole thing. So we're going to quit with that right now because that's the end. What's going to be fun, at least I'm looking forward to it, I've been reading about it, is chapter 49. Then Jacob called his sons together. Now the whole family is going to be together. If the whole family was there with the two sons of Jacob or Joseph, maybe not. But in chapter 49, the whole family's there, and he's going to give some kind of a blessing to each one of his sons individually that's going to be pertaining to them, their life, their family. But then it's going to extend into the future, even the distant future, on what's taking place, which is just, again, a shocking thing for my Western mind, that when it talks about the sins of the fathers follow their children to the third and fourth generation, some of the behaviors of these boys is going to determine their family line for ages, which is like, well, yeah, but what about individual? It's like, no, you came from somewhere, you belong to a group somewhere, and you're continuing the legacy or living with the repercussions of your past. Again, that's not talking about, you know, salvation through Christ. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, the curses. But it is that we're part of a people. At least they considered it that way at that time. I'll pray, and we'll pick up those blessings to the sons and prophecies next time. Father, I do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We ask that we may make application to our own lives, that we would ourselves walk fearful before you, being obedient, but also knowing that you are our shepherd, leading us as you lead us through our own lives. We do thank you for our past that we've had, and we ask that you may help us lay a good foundation for the future, for the people we are interact with today, but also the people that come after us in the years to come, that we would lay a foundation and shine a light towards you, that they may find their way and walk in the truth that you've revealed to all of us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your patience.